ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Prime Minister isn't ruling out a Commonwealth Royal Commission into the Bondi terror attack amid growing pressure from his own party. Also, the deposed Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife plead not guilty in a New York court. And locals react to their footy field disappearing into a massive sinkhole in Melbourne.
When we first saw the images online, we weren't too sure if it was real or not, so we thought we'd pop down and have a look.
A bit scary just thinking because I live so close to it and like I play footy here.
First this evening, after weeks of pressure, there are media reports today that the Prime Minister will most likely bow to demands a Commonwealth Royal Commission be held into the Bondi terror attack. A growing number of former Labor MPs, senators and party officials are reportedly urging Mr Albanese to agree to a national inquiry. Political reporter Holly Tregenza is at Parliament House in Canberra. Holly, what's the Prime Minister had to say today about the prospect of a Commonwealth Royal Commission?
Well, before Christmas, we saw a couple of Labor MPs break ranks to join the push for a royal commission. And today there's evidence of even more pressure coming from within his own party. This group of former Labor MPs and senators signed this letter calling for a national royal commission. And they're also raising concerns that a state-level inquiry wouldn't have the same sort of power as a federal one. And there's a concern, despite the government's commitment to cooperate with this planned New South Wales Royal Commission, that this state inquiry just wouldn't be able to compel institutions and individuals beyond its jurisdiction to give evidence. Now, the Prime Minister was in flood-affected Queensland today and continued to be dogged by these questions on a royal commission, as he has been at every press conference in the last few weeks. He said the government's priority remains the security and intelligence review, which is being led by the former spy boss, Dennis Richardson. And it's this review that they say will deliver much faster results than a royal commission. But the Prime Minister left the door open to the possibility of a federal inquiry.
The New South Wales government have said that they will have a royal commission, but we're talking to New South Wales about how that would operate, and we're talking with the community. We are engaged with the community as well as with the New South Wales government to make sure that we get done everything that is required.
Now, that's a bit of a change in tone from the Prime Minister compared to the last few weeks, where he's been more dismissive of the need for a federal royal commission, saying it would simply take too long. He was in that press conference asked twice and given the opportunity to rule out a royal commission, and he didn't do so. You can hear there also that the Prime Minister was also insisting that the government is listening to the community and wanting unity. And it's been pointed out by opposition leader Susan Lee that there is unity in some respects on wanting a royal commission. Of course, we heard from these former Labor MPs and senators today, but in the last weeks, we've heard from a number of business leaders, eminent Australians, faith leaders, sporting heroes, and of course, the families of some of the victims of the Bondi attack who all say they want a royal commission. I think it's worth noting that the PM did say today that the priority for the government remains the security and intelligence review, and we're expected to have an interim report as early as April. The other priority is readying legislation on hate speech and on gun reform so that the PM can call the parliament early, and we're expecting that that could happen within the next 2 weeks.
And Holly, Mr Albanese has been touring the flood-affected areas of Queensland today. He's been in Cloncurry. What has he announced for the affected communities?
We'd normally see the Prime Minister at the SCG today for the pink test, but instead he was visiting these flood-affected areas in Queensland, meeting with the community and emergency workers trying to deal with this ongoing emergency. And the Prime Minister has announced an additional $38 million through disaster recovery funding arrangements for flood-affected communities in northwest Queensland. And it includes relief for primary producers, but also critical repairs for things like the Cloncurry Airport. The Prime Minister said the funding would help those communities get back on their feet. But of course, there's a chance this is still not over. There's a possibility of more bad weather later in the week for this area of the state.
And Holly, finally, tributes are being paid today to the longtime Nationals MP, Ron Boswell, who's died at 85. How is he being remembered?
Yeah, the Nationals are mourning the death of this former long-serving Senator Ron Boswell, who died overnight. And he was known as Bozzy to his mates, and his political career really spanned decades. He served in the Senate for more than 30 years. He was a real champion for the bush. When he retired, he nominated his improvements to bush telecommunications as one of the highlights of his career. He also really notably took on One Nation's Pauline Hanson in an electoral battle in 2001 and defeated her. One of his more memorable campaign slogans was Ron Boswell, he's not pretty, but he's pretty effective. The tributes have flowed today from all pockets of politics. Nationals leader David Littleproud describing him as a giant, and former Liberal Prime Minister John Howard describing him as a genuine article. John Howard wrote, he was loyal and tenacious, and although we had disagreed on some issues, he never lost my affection and respect. So certainly a giant of Australian politics and a crusader for the bush.
That's Holly Tregenza, our political reporter at Parliament House in Canberra. In New York, the deposed Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores have appeared in court and pleaded not guilty to drug trafficking and weapons charges. Outside the courtroom, opposing groups of protesters chanted and heckled. And around the world, similar division is evident as leaders react to the United States' arrest of Venezuela's authoritarian leader. Julia Bergen prepared this report.
Thank God for Donald Trump! He has liberated the Venezuelans!
Protesters outside the New York court, where ousted Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro stood before a US judge and pleaded not guilty to drug trafficking and weapons offences.
There is no going back. Nicolás Maduro today is going to be brought to justice after 14 years of running our country, after more than 20 years of a ruthless dictatorship.
The U.S. has no right to be holding the president of Venezuela and his wife, Celia Flores, in U.S. courts.
Inside, the deposed president and his wife, Celia Flores, both maintaining their innocence after United States forces captured them and flew them to the US to face US federal charges. I am innocent. I'm not guilty. I'm a decent man, the president of my country, Maduro told the court through an interpreter. It's the beginning of what's expected to be a long legal battle for Maduro and Flores. But already opinion is split locally, nationally, and internationally. Within the US government, a number of Democrats have condemned the president's actions, including Senator Chris Murphy.
It has nothing to do with the Venezuelan people because it appears as if they are leaving Maduro's party in charge. The repression will continue. It has nothing to do with drugs coming to the United States because Venezuela wasn't sending drugs to the United States. They were sending drugs to Europe. Increasingly, Donald Trump is saying out loud that it's just about the oil.
And Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
Maduro is a tyrant. Nobody mourns what has happened to him.
But he says the Trump administration owes the American people answers.
Most importantly, what the hell does Donald Trump mean when he says the United States now intends to run Venezuela? Does this mean we're now in the business of nation-building Venezuela? Are we going to put troops on the ground?
Chuck Schumer also issued this warning.
Donald Trump has opened a Pandora's box, and things will get out of hand very quickly. And if Donald Trump tries to do to Colombia and Greenland what he did in Venezuela, the disasters and consequences could compound exponentially.
Republican lawmakers have, however, argued the U.S. operation in Venezuela was decisive and justified. The Republican House Speaker is Mike Johnson.
We are not at war. We do not have U.S. armed forces in Venezuela, and we are not occupying that country. The Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war. That is true. But it also vests the President of the United States with vast authorities as Commander-in-Chief. Under Article 2 of the Constitution, the president has the authority, as all presidents do, to deploy military forces to address threats to the U.S. and to enforce U.S. law.
But other Republicans are concerned. Thomas Massie, who has long clashed with President Trump, took to social media saying, "Wake up, MAGA. Venezuela is not about drugs. It's about oil and regime change. This is not what we voted for." The UN Security Council met to discuss the legality of the US operation. While some countries praised US President Donald Trump, others condemned him, and many more stressed the importance of international order. Back in Venezuela, their own legislature has kicked into gear. In Maduro's absence, the country has sworn in a new interim leader, former Vice President Delcy Rodriguez, and new lawmakers, headed by Delcy Rodriguez's brother, Jorge Rodriguez.
My main role in the days to come, my role as a man, as a representative, as president of this National Assembly, will be to use all procedures, all platforms, and all spaces to bring back Nicolas Maduro Moro, my brother, my president.
The deposed president's son, Nicolas Ernesto Maduro Guerra, also spoke as the National Assembly was sworn in.
They may have kidnapped Nicolas and Celia, but they did not kidnap the conscience of a people who have decided to be free. To you, Delcy Eluena, I offer my unconditional support for the difficult task that lies ahead. We stand firm in absolute unity to achieve the goals of peace in Venezuela, to move the country forward and to bring Nicolas and Celia back home.
While Venezuela's interim government has made their allegiances clear, many people in the country have taken to the streets to celebrate what they see as the end of the Maduro regime.
Today we are here celebrating what many Venezuelans have been waiting for 26 years. We have fought to get rid of this regime, which has only gotten worse over time.
That report from Julia Bergen. Dr. Raul Sanchez Uribarri is an associate professor of legal studies at La Trobe University in Melbourne. Born and raised in Venezuela, he moved to Australia more than a decade ago and has written a book on the Maduro regime. I asked him what life has been like for Venezuelans under the presidency.
We've lost almost 80%. Of our economy, of our GDP in the last 10 years. Over 8 million people have left the country. That's almost a quarter. I went to Venezuela, for example, in 2023, and it's beyond belief what I saw. I mean, the country is unrecognizable. No whole avenues, streets with empty shops, no homes vacated. It's really an uncanny and really hard thing to see.
The United States is accusing Maduro of conspiracy to traffic drugs. Do you think there's any credibility to those allegations?
It is hard to say exactly what that would mean. There are some claims that I feel less confident personally than others. So I have no doubt, however, that there can be any number of links between Maduro government personnel and, of course, any number of drug trafficking arrangements.
Do you think the United States' intervention in Venezuela breached international law?
I do think that it breached international law, and I think that the event in on itself will be analyzed as not only the incident itself, but also an example, of course, of the deterioration of the efficacy of international law and the decay of the rules-based international order worldwide. That's something that has been happening for a number of years. It's not also only after the Trump administration. I think it's a process that has been happening for a number of years. And in fact, even the situation of Venezuela, as we see it today, is also a demonstration of the lack of efficacy of international law. International law, in that sense, failed Venezuelans for a number of years. Now, it's a country where that experienced severe human rights violations at a mass level, and there was very little that could be done.
So there seems to be a lot of confusion at the moment. Who do you think is actually going to run Venezuela from here on in?
There seems to be an arrangement, an entanglement of some sort of understanding between the Trump administration and the Chavista regime. I mean, this case, at the helm is Delcy Rodriguez. She was the vice president also for the economic side of things in Venezuela portfolio, and now interim president according to the Supreme Court's last ruling. Now, what exactly does that mean for the country is yet to be seen. In theory, what we're seeing is that the U.S. expects Delcy Rodriguez to carry out a mandate that complies with certain requirements for purposes of bolstering the economy, but ultimately also for allowing U.S. oil companies to establish themselves in the country. Delcy Rodriguez has a very hard task for herself within Venezuela for two reasons. First, because the Chavista regime, particularly Maduro, but Chavism in general, is really unpopular. No, very unpopular. Population are angry. I mean, this is a country where, like, last year, and vote or 2024, voted heavily against Maduro and in favor of the opposition candidate for replacing Maduro. And of course, Maduro ended up staying in power nonetheless. But the issue is, she knows she's very unpopular. She's starting from that basis, a government that can deliver. But second, with these recent moves, and especially with her understanding with Trump, hey, there are any number of allies, of people within the Chavista coalition that are actually quite unhappy. So how exactly is this going to work in practice is yet to be seen.
What can you tell us about Delcy Rodriguez and her politics? Is she different from Maduro?
As a character within the Chavista regime, definitely, yes. Her reputation is one of a technocrat. Someone that I have heard, for example, from other people, someone who is efficient, someone who gets the economy, so to speak. I mean, that was the reputation that she cultivated for herself. She was educated, I think, in labor law in France, and she's now younger than Maduro. And she's the sister of Jorge Rodriguez, who is also a well-known and really influential politician within Chavismo, one of the most influential, and now president of the National Assembly, the country's parliament. So she's a very different figure. Now, what will that translate into practice? We'll need to see. It's very hard to know right now whether she's going to be a leader who's going to last for the longer haul, whether she's going to be an interim leader. And anyone who tells you otherwise tells you, no, I know exactly what's going to happen in Venezuela next week. Don't believe him.
Dr. Raul Sanchez Uribarri is an Associate Professor of Legal Studies at La Trobe Uni in Melbourne. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. A survivor of childhood sexual abuse is calling on governments to change the way victims are compensated. Victorian Richard Turner argues court proceedings re-traumatise those seeking justice. And a warning, you may find some of the details in this report distressing. Here's Kimberly Price.
When Richard Turner was 10 years old, he says he was abused by his Beaumaris primary school teacher and later convicted paedophile Darryl Ray.
So the touching became hugging. He would kiss me on the cheek occasionally. He would give me a bear hug. And ultimately he raped me in about March of 1974.
When Richard Turner moved to Brighton Grammar School, he says he was abused by another teacher, Ian Bridge.
So out of Beaumaris Primary and 12 months later, I'm back to being groomed and abused by another man that I thought cared about me.
Ian Bridge died in 1982 and Darryl Ray died during criminal proceedings against him based on Richard Turner's accusations. So in 2023, he turned to civil proceedings against the schools and the state of Victoria. After 2 years, Richard Turner settled out of court and was awarded compensation. But when survivors receive compensation, many are required to repay any Centrelink, Medicare and private health insurance payments they've received relating to their abuse.
So the view is that, oh, we've compensated you enough in your settlement. That's been allowed for, but it's a fallacy.
Richard Turner had to pay back over $90,000 to his private health insurance for 3 stays at a mental health clinic during his criminal and civil proceedings. While these amounts are taken into account when compensation is calculated, they are subtracted from the lump sum before the money reaches survivors' bank accounts.
This money represents my abuse, and knowing that they'd also taken money from me, surely I can't be the only one that feels that way. And it needs to change.
Richard Turner believes the system should be streamlined and any repayments should be accounted for early in the process so that survivors can plan for the full amount they'll receive. Sexual Assault Services Victoria CEO Kathleen Maltzahn supports this proposed change and is pushing for further reforms.
We would say if you've paid your insurance dues and they've been written off, often many years ago, too late for the insurer to come back.
She believes the onus is on the federal government to create a more streamlined system.
Governments increasingly are understanding the impact of historic institutional child abuse and doing everything they can to improve things for survivors, and this is absolutely fixable.
In a statement, the Department of Social Services said compensation recovery is a long-standing practice in the social security and health systems where payments are made. Private Healthcare Australia, the industry's peak body, in a statement said that health insurers, in accordance with law, are entitled to be refunded for any benefits they have paid on behalf of members who have sustained personal injuries they later receive compensation for. Michael Bradley is a managing partner at Mark Lawyers and a board member of the Grace Tame Foundation. He says not many survivors realise these repayments are required.
Very few people know that that's a thing, and so yeah, it tends to come as a pretty unpleasant surprise when they get to that point of the process.
Richard Turner wants other survivors thinking about taking legal action to understand what could be required of their settlements from the beginning of their cases.
I'm absolutely determined to have a voice to help others that didn't have this incredible support I've been given. So, as they say, don't let the bastards win.
Abuse survivor and victims advocate Richard Turner, Kimberly Price reporting. And if this story has raised concerns for you or anyone you know, please do call Lifeline on 13 11 14. One of the Victorian government's most expensive construction projects has come to a grinding halt after a large sinkhole swallowed part of a footy oval. The hole opened up in the area where two boring machines were digging for what's known as the North East Tunnel Project. Kathleen O'Connor prepared this report.
The video circulating on social media looks like something created by AI, but the sinkhole that swallowed a large portion of an oval is real.
Wow.
Banyule Cricket Club president Brad Bowler says he initially thought the photos were a hoax.
When I first saw it, I thought it was fake, so I went down to look to make sure it was real, and I was trying to make sure no one was hurt.
Residents in the suburb of Heidelberg in Melbourne's northeast came across the 8-metre gaping hole on their local footy oval on Monday evening, not far from one of the state government's major construction projects, the $26 billion Northeast Link, part of what the Labor government calls the big build.
When we first saw the images online, we weren't too sure if it was real or not, so we thought we'd pop down and have a look.
We live about 500 metres away from the oval, so obviously a bit of concern if there's anything more going on. But
a bit scary just thinking because I live so close to it and like I play footy here.
Two boring machines used for the Northeast Link were digging close to the oval. They've since been stopped and an investigation has been launched. Duncan Elliott is the CEO of the Victorian Infrastructure and Delivery Authority.
We are actually confident that the tunnel boring machines have been a contributing factor, not necessarily caused the problem, but certainly a contributing factor, and that's part of the investigation, is to understand how that's occurred.
Duncan Elliott says it's too early to determine the exact cause of the sinkhole and whether there's any cost impact, but the investigation is likely to take weeks.
There has been no injuries, there's been no damage to property, and our foremost priority now is to ensure that people don't come and get inside that exclusion zone whilst we undertake the rectification works.
Around the same time last year, works on the same project came to a halt after the discovery of a 20-metre deep sinkhole not far from where the football ground is located.
Clearly we don't like this stuff happening. It's not designed to happen. These are the best machines in the world. These are machines that have been purpose-built and designed for this sort of geology.
It's not the first time a significant sinkhole has appeared near a major tunnel project. In March 2024, one opened up above the $3 billion M6 construction project in Sydney South and is yet to be repaired. And back in 2005, a section of the roof of the Lane Cove Tunnel collapsed, almost swallowing a block of flats in Sydney's north. Professor Jocelyn McPhee is a geologist at the University of Tasmania.
In general, sinkholes, we know very clearly the result of the ground collapsing downwards because its support has been removed from underneath. The Melbourne region has geology that you would not normally expect to find sinkholes in.
Victoria's State Emergency Service has warned the sinkhole may continue to grow and is urging the public not to attempt to access it. Jocelyn McPhee says it's likely to happen.
Yes, it's a very common pattern. They only ever get bigger. They don't start to kind of rebuild. And if the process that originally created the first little hole that then got bigger and bigger, if that process continues to operate, then the hole will get larger and larger.
Professor Jocelyn McPhee from the University of Tasmania, Kathleen O'Connor, the reporter. Thanks very much for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Good night.